Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Michael Stone is one of the most notorious gunmen of the Troubles. The Loyalist has 6 murder convictions. He hit the headlines in March 1988, launching a gun and bomb attack in Milltown Cemetery in West Belfast, in full view of the TV cameras. His targets, mourners at the funerals of 3 IRA members shot dead by the SAS in Gibraltar.
We now had the dead Republicans, and there was going to be a high-profile funeral. So it was fortuitous for me, you know. So for 10 days, I was ready for 10 days, you know.
3 people died in the Milltown attack.
It was literally like a dance of death, you know. They were hiding behind headstones, and if a target produced itself, I shot it.
Charged by the angry crowd, Stone escaped with his life when he was rescued by an RUC patrol.
Many of the crowd gave chase in hot pursuit of the man who stopped, turned, and threw another grenade. Others kept up pursuit as their quarry drew a handgun and fired at them. Still threatening his pursuers, the gunman ran along the motorway. He was eventually caught by the mob and attacked before being arrested by the police and taken to hospital.
He was, up to that point, unknown to the public, but in fact well known to loyalists as a gun for hire.
He rose through the ranks. He was in various paramilitary groups, the UDA and the Red Hand Commando, and he got this reputation as being a ruthless gunman and became a gun for hire.
He later made the headlines for a foiled attack on Stormont, which he claimed was performance art.
Michael Stone was being grappled to the floor by security. He was shouting, "I have a bomb, I have a bomb." He was also shouting, "No surrender."
Joining me to discuss Stone, his crimes, and his artistic endeavours are the editor of The Sunday Life, Martin Breen, and the former editor of The Belfast Telegraph, Ed Curran. You're both very welcome to The Bell Tale. Martin, can I start with you? Who is Michael Stone? Because for many of our listeners, that's an almost ridiculous question. But there are listeners perhaps under, let's say, 35. They mightn't really know who Michael Stone is.
Well, Stone was one of the most notorious paramilitaries that emerged from the Troubles. He was actually born in England to English parents, and he believes his birth mother may actually have been a Catholic. When he was younger, his parents split up and his father enrolled in the Merchant Navy. So Stone moved to live with a family in Ballyhalbert before moving to the Branyell Estate, where he became involved in street gangs and eventually with the loyalist gangs. And he rose through the ranks. He was in various paramilitary groups, the UDA and the Red Hand Commando. And he got this reputation as being a ruthless gunman and became a gun for hire. He has been convicted of 6 murders. He's been linked to dozens and dozens of other crimes. For the Milltown Cemetery massacre, he was sentenced to 684 years in prison in total, but he obviously got out under the Good Friday Agreement before he was returned again for his attack at Stormont in 2006, when he claimed he was going to murder Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams. Now, Stone has himself claimed that his murder claims at Stormont were actually a work of performance art. The judge at his trial found that wholly unconvincing, and Stone was carrying axes, knives and homemade fireworks, an explosive type device.
It ruled today that Michael Stone's attack at Parliament Buildings 2 years ago was an attempt to kill.
The Loyalist was found guilty of trying to murder the Sinn Féin leaders Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, and guilty of possessing explosives and causing criminal damage.
But Stone obviously knew he was going to grab the headlines when he entered Stormont. He was a very ill man at the time. He suffers from a muscle wasting condition, which is very debilitating. And by all accounts, it took him almost 2 hours to get up the avenue to Stormont. So who knows if he had ever managed to get into the chamber at Stormont to get near any Sinn Féin politicians. But just as it happened at Milltown, all this was played out in front of the cameras, and he earned himself the nickname the television terrorist.
He had killed people before Milltown. I want to talk about that. But there's a bizarre story that he was recruited into the UDA after killing a dog.
Yes. So Stone in the early 70s was in a tartan gang on the Branyell estate. And through this, he met Tommy Harran, who's the commander of the UDA in East Belfast. And according to Stone, and he's written about this in his autobiography, Harran took him and three friends to the Castlereagh Hills one day and brought a German Shepherd dog with them. And after the four had played around with the dog, Harran produced a gun and told them to kill the dog. And after the three friends refused, it was Stone himself who shot the animal, and he was praised by Harran for being ruthless. After this, he was sworn in as a member of the UDA. So, you know, in those days, Stone, you know, was only a teenager, and he already was getting a thirst for blood.
And he had murdered people before Milltown.
Yes, he murdered three people that we know of. He murdered Catholic milkman Patrick Brady, who he said he targeted because Brady was a member of Sinn Féin. That was in November 1984. The following year, he killed Catholic joiner Kevin McPolin in Lisburn. And then in 1987, he murdered Dermot Hackett, who is a bread delivery man down in County Tyrone. Now, subsequently, Stone has claimed that he admitted two of those murders to protect others in the UDA. He now denies that he murdered Dermot Hackett and Kevin McPolin, which is quite interesting because they were the two who he was unable really to link to Sinn Féin. Or, you know, with Milltown, he was saying, you know, he was bringing the war to the IRA as he saw it. He said that in his own words by attacking that funeral. He's tried to justify one of his murders by saying they were a member of Sinn Féin. But even though he previously met with the family of Dermot Hackett, and he had admitted it publicly in that, he went back on it and claims he didn't. So what the truth is, we may never really know.
And there's this shocking sort of documentary footage. I think it was facilitated by Dr. Desmond Tutu, where he met the victims, some of his victims. You know, it's my judgment, but, you know, it was very upsetting for everyone involved. And I think a lot of people would reflect on that. Can I bring you in, Ed Curran, now? I mean, we've brought the story to Milltown. You remember the Milltown Cemetery massacre, and indeed, ultimately, you interviewed Stone after that.
Yes. First of all, can I say that I can corroborate the story about the dog, because Stone told that to me personally in the Mays prison. And I was quite astonished, because he also said to me that he loved dogs. And that made it all the more difficult for him when he stepped up that Sunday afternoon, I think it was, and took the gun and shot dead the shepherd dog, which then set him into a career in the Loyalist paramilitaries. But my initial interest in Michael Stone came in 1988, when one day I received a telephone call from a relative of his who was commenting on a story that we'd run in the Sunday Light newspaper. Robert, his name was, his relative, said to me he wanted to pass on a message from Michael Stone, whom he met in the prison. And the message was that he thought the Sunday Life was treating him better than some of the other newspapers, in that they were not referring to him as the maniacal, crazed or notorious killer. In our stories, we tended to be more objective, he said, about how we reported what he had done and what we thought about him personally. And he just wanted to pass that on. And then Robert said to me, would you like to meet him? And my initial reaction was, frankly, as the editor of the newspaper, no, I don't really want to get too directly involved with Loyalist or Republican paramilitaries, because we had a reputation for being really in the middle of all of this that was going on. And I thought about it then afterwards, and I went and looked at Michael Stone's file, and in particular what was said at his trial when he was convicted of the killings. And to my surprise, I noted that he hadn't given any evidence. And so therefore, we did not know his side of the story as to why he'd done what he did in Milltown Cemetery. So I changed my mind and I rang Robert, his relative, and I said to him, second thoughts, I think I'd like to meet Michael Stone if you can arrange it. And he said, well, I can, but he only gets one visit a week because he is regarded as the most dangerous prisoner on the Loyalist side, along with about 20 Republicans on the Republican side. And then suddenly I got the Mays Prison kind of invite to meet Michael Stone on his one visit a week. And I said off to meet him. At one point, I kept thinking to myself, this is an incredible waste of time here. Because when you got to the prison, everything had to be removed from you, including even a handkerchief from your clothes, etc. No pens, no notebooks. And then you were put into a visitor's room where you sat with Republican and Loyalist. And then someone would call out the number of the prisoner. And I think I'm right that this was the number 324. And basically, I'm sitting there quietly, and then someone calls out, 324. And everyone looks at me immediately because they all know that number is Michael Stone's. And then at that point, you get up and you go and you get into a vehicle that had no windows, along with some of these parents and the relatives of Republican and Loyalist prisoners. And you're taken on this journey through the prison to the visitors' compound. And Michael Stone was sitting there with his ponytail. And I remember thinking, he's quite strongly built, and he had kind of muscular short sleeve shirt on, which kind of showed the fact that, to my mind, he'd been working in the gym. So he sat there opposite me, and standing about 10 feet away was a guard or a prison warder. And he said to me, you know, that warder has to stay there because he was a Red Book prisoner. I think he was the only Red Book prisoner of the Loyalists, whereas there were about 20 Republican Red Book prisoners. So these were deemed by the authorities to be the most dangerous prisoners, and therefore at all times they had someone within 10 or 12 feet of them, even when they were talking to a visitor like me. And so we had that conversation. I think I was limited to half an hour. That was all his visit was. And we agreed that I'd come back and I'd meet him again, and I met him again. And he had a kind of wry sense of humor. One day he said to me, while we were sitting facing each other in this little cubicle, open cubicle, by the way, you can see everybody else around you. He said, that's Cleeky Clark at the next cubicle. Now, Cleeky Clark was a bodyguard for Gerry Adams, but he also had been involved in killings of the two corporals at Andersonstown. And I think he might have been jailed at that time for that. And then, at any rate, he said, he's probably trying to kill me, and I would probably want to kill him. And he said, well, probably at our most vulnerable if we're together in the toilets or something like that. Now, one day he said to me, you know, Ed, that warder is pretty useless about 10 feet away from us. And I said, well, why do you say that, Michael? And he said, because if I just reach across this table, I could snap your neck before he would ever arrive to save you. And I laughed. And then I thought to myself afterwards when I walked out, gosh, you know, he's absolutely right. And what would he have to lose? But at any rate, it didn't happen, thankfully.
I remember Milltown very well. The footage is extraordinary, and the aftermath was extraordinary. Martin, could you tell us what happened in Milltown?
So, Milltown Cemetery attack was on the day of three IRA funerals. There were three provisional IRA members killed by the SAS in Gibraltar. So tensions were high at the time, and Stone, seeing his opportunity, decided to target the funeral. And specifically, he has said he wanted to kill Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams, who were among the mourners. So he basically approached the cemetery from the nearby M1 motorway, and he proceeded to shoot and throw grenades in any direction towards mourners.
Get down, get down, get down, get down, get down.
In the end, three men were killed, one of whom was a member of the IRA. Now, the Republican crowd chased Stone and badly beat him, but he was rescued by the police and arrested.
People might find it hard to believe this man was acting alone.
Well, Stone has claimed that, but police believe that he had to have, you know, others helping him with planning. Now, he admitted in an interview to me a few years ago that the gun that was used in the attack had been given to him by an RUC officer who was also in the UDA. It's understood that a police officer later took his own life. So obviously there was somebody conspiring with him and helping him to carry this out. But in terms of this attack, he had approached various organisations to try and get their backing, to try and probably bring in other paramilitaries with him to launch a mass attack. But I think there was a reticence amongst many that, you know, that this was a mission of suicide. How is he going to get away? And Stone didn't really seem to have thought that out, because he was very quickly apprehended, first by the crowd and then by the police. But no doubt with his connections, there were others involved, and the ballistic history on the gun used show it had been a police weapon.
Ed, you've interviewed him. Did he talk about his paramilitary, I suppose for want of a better word, career? Did he talk about Milltown?
Yes, you have to bear in mind that I was limited in the interviews that I had with him because of the time limit there was, because of the one visit every now and again. But yes, I found it very difficult at times to separate fact from what might have been fiction. He came across to me as at times being a slightly Walter Mitty figure, and I know that he has been convicted of 6 murders, but there are doubts as to his involvement in some of those. And I sometimes wondered when he was talking to me how much of what he was saying was totally accurate. There's no doubt, clearly, from the conversations I had with him, that he was a bit of a loose cannon, that he basically was a freelance mercenary in the Loyalist paramilitaries. I suspect that they were very distrustful at times, often because they didn't know what he was really up to. I mean, even that story about where he got the gun from, again, it's very difficult to corroborate a lot of the things that he said.
Freelance, lone wolf, loose cannon, Walter Mitty. He does seem to be a very different person in terms of his personality and modus operandi. At least that's the impression that we're getting here. He nevertheless killed people, but how integrated was he with the Loyalists? I know it's almost an impossible question, but perhaps we could put that in context of his prison life.
While he was in the Mays prison, and indeed when he was in McGabbery prison, when he was returned to jail, definitely on the Loyalist wing, he was very much protected and taken care of, especially in his latter years in prison, because he was barely able to walk. He wasn't in the greatest of health. So I know a lot of younger Loyalist prisoners apparently looked up to him and, you know, would have been running errands and things like that for him. Obviously, whenever he was released from the Mays prison under the Good Friday Agreement, you know, there was a huge fanfare among Loyalists when he walked through the prison doors. Whenever he was campaigning for a yes vote in the Good Friday Agreement among the Loyalist paramilitaries, he was feted on stage, very much celebrated. I think for many Loyalist paramilitaries, they may think he's a Walter Mitty in that. I think that because of the nature of the Milltown Cemetery attack, I think he would have respect in some Loyalist paramilitary circles. Now, I would say after the incident at Stormont in November 2006, after which he was convicted of attempting to murder Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, I think a lot of Loyalists would have distanced themselves from him then. And while he was being looked after in McGabbey prison by them, that was more out of respect for his past than what unfolded at Stormont.
Ed, before I talk about the Stormont thing in more detail, did Michael Stone ever mention politics? Did he have any political stance? Or was he, like, I suppose, a pure paramilitary?
His political stance was that he regarded the IRA, and in particular Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, as being his sworn enemies. And he would go to any lengths to kill them. He said to me, "I don't have anything against ordinary Catholics. Just basically see the Republican movement and its leadership as being the enemy. And I'm dedicated to wiping that enemy out." And, you know, that started before the Milltown Cemetery, where he would have seen Sinn Féin councillors or people like that involved in the Republican movement as just simply the enemy, and he would have thought nothing about killing them.
The primary targets, Adams and McGuinness. I had failed to assassinate them, and that's what I set out to do. Personally speaking, I see the Milltown operation as a failure militarily.
One point about the day or the Milltown Cemetery event, I find it quite incredulous that he had some webbing, a kind of a webbing waistcoat, and in this waistcoat he had these pockets, and the pockets were full of grenades, and he had concealed underneath his coat his guns and grenades, etc. And when I spoke to him, he seemed to claim that he'd gone into Belfast on the bus with this, all this weaponry, and then that he'd wandered up the Falls Road and he'd thought about going to the church where the Requiem Mass was being celebrated for the Gibraltar dead, and then he thought he might kill Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness in the church, but he then decided, no, I think I'll go to the cemetery. So it was a very kind of ad hoc, strange kind of way of going about what turned out to be one of the most notorious events of the entire Troubles.
We've mentioned the Stormont incident several times, Martin. Can you explain what happened there? And I mean, this thankfully no one lost their lives in this, and we can look back at it and say this was an utterly bizarre happening.
Just like his first attempt to kill Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams, this again was played out on the TV cameras. Stone walked up Prince of Wales Avenue towards Stormont. Now, he claims at one stage of his 2-hour walk he had to crawl. Now, whenever he got through the door of Parliament Buildings, he pointed his gun at a female security guard, ignited the device in a flight bag and threw it some yards for him. It sort of sparked, but it failed to explode. And then he was apprehended at the front door of Stormont by two members of the security staff who grabbed him and pinned his hands behind his back and took the weapons from him. When police went through the bag, they discovered that, you know, there were also 7 nail bombs which were capable of causing death or serious injury to anyone in their proximity, as well as 3 knives, a hatchet and a garrote. Stone told police then that he went there specifically to assassinate Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness and to disrupt assembly proceedings. He claimed they were war criminals, and he said that if he would have got in, he would have stabbed them both and cut their throats.
During his trial, the prosecution quoted from police interviews with Stone, during which he claimed that once inside Parliament Buildings, he'd planned to lob nail bombs into the Assembly chamber to cause confusion. He said he would then have stabbed Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, who he referred to as war criminals.
He quite clearly...
He could barely walk, but...
He could barely walk, yes. He's got a degenerative condition, which means that it would be unlikely, and he said himself, it would be unlikely he could have ever made it into the Assembly chamber. And, you know, he maintains that this was all a work of performance art, which, you know, has got to be one of the most bizarre excuses in a criminal trial here for some time. He admits it was eccentric. He said the bombs were only flashbangs and it was a simulation. He said he intended to take the rockets as close to Parliament Buildings as he could and set them off like a firework display. He claims it was black humour that has backfired on him. The judge at his trial said that was wholly unconvincing and sentenced him to 16 years for the armed attack. To this day, Stone maintains that it was a work of theatre, that he never meant to kill them. He has said his war is over, that, you know, he's no longer involved in paramilitarism. He's you know, he's probably still a loyalist and will be until the day he dies.
I don't look back at Milltown or any of the other incidents, you know, paramilitary incidents I was involved with pride. I don't, because you can't take pride in killing somebody. But I don't look back on it with shame. You know, I'm proud to have been a member of the UDA, proud to have put myself forward to try and defend my family, community and country. And all that, I know that sounds cliched, but that's the truth and that's who I am.
Ed, do you think Michael Stone is a man who craves attention?
Oh, I think undoubtedly he saw himself as a loyalist hero and as a kind of saviour of Northern Ireland and dire and most feared opponent of the Republican movement. He was also, as Martin has said, he was held in high respect within the loyalist paramilitary and the wider loyalist community. I saw this, by the way, at first hand in the most bizarre encounter I had with him when he left prison. I was attending a Rangers versus Celtic football match in Glasgow, and a lot of fans, Rangers and Celtic fans, had gone over for this match on a Sunday morning at Highbrook's Park. And I was staying with my wife and some friends in the Hilton Hotel in Glasgow. And the foyer and the main reception room of the Hilton Hotel was absolutely packed with fans. And suddenly the lift doors opened at one end of the foyer. And I could see that there was Michael Stone coming out of the lift with a couple of supporters or henchmen or whatever you might with him, tough looking guys. And I thought to myself, he knows me and he surely wouldn't come and directly to speak to me. And that's exactly what he did. So I'm sitting there in the middle of this crowded Hilton Hotel, and this man who is notorious and noted by so many people in that room comes directly over to me and says, "Hello, Ed," in a kind of rather personable fashion. And I could see some people really almost bristling. But there was a postscript to that. First of all, it was quite clear that there were a lot of people who were in favour of Michael Stone and would love to see him in Glasgow. And he would visit paramilitary bars, but loyalist bars and so on, Rangers supporters clubs, and there were T-shirts and everything with Michael Stone. But that particular day, there was a postscript to it, because someone who obviously didn't like him had spotted him. And that evening, the Hilton Hotel received a bomb scare, a serious bomb scare, and the manager of the hotel clearly panicked, and he decided to evacuate the entire hotel, which was packed. And there was a Variety Club of Great Britain dinner going on in it, and I was attending that. So we were all turfed out on the street around midnight, and we had to spend the night in another hotel about half a mile away and walk there in the driving rain. And when I got there, I found that Michael Stone and his friends were there too. And the irony for me was that I was with my wife and we were trying to find somewhere to sleep underneath a platform in the hotel, underneath the stage, because we had nowhere else to sleep. And we were still in our dinner jackets and evening dresses and all sorts of things. And Stone's friends came over to me to try and check if myself and my wife were okay. And I thought this was a strange irony. And we were returned back to the Hilton Hotel the following day. But the whole incident had been caused in the first place, almost certainly, by the appearance of Michael Stone that afternoon coming out of that lift shaft. And as I was leaving, I bumped into a Celtic reporter who had attended the match. And he said to me, "You'd never believe what happened to me last night." And he said, "I was evacuating the hotel and I was carrying my suitcase. And this man came up to me and said to me, 'Could I give you a hand with that suitcase down the stairs?'" And he said, "It was Michael Stone." And I thought, that is some picture, the Celtic supporter being helped by Michael Stone with his suitcase. But broadly speaking, what I would say about Stone was that he had a kind of personable style about him, and I can see why a lot of people kind of just took him at face value on that. But you had to always believe that behind that facade was a killer. And sometimes it was easy to forget that when you were sitting chatting to him and he could be so matter-of-fact.
There seems to be so many bizarre stories about Michael Stone. He's a gift, in many ways, to a tabloid news editor, Martin, if we're honest. But one of the strange twists of this is that he reinvented himself as an artist of sorts. And again, that's been the source of many stories.
Yes, while he was in prison, he took up artwork and he seems to have got quite good at it. He has sold quite a few paintings. He has claimed over the years that people who have bought them included the late Secretary of State, Mo Mollam, the lap dancing club boss, Peter Stringfellow. He said he was selling them for around £10,000. eBay had a painting listed, which was raising just over £1,000 whenever it was taken off eBay and moved onto Facebook. Now, the seller claims to have subsequently sold it for £4,500. When I spoke to Stone myself in McGabry Prison in 2008, he claimed that art dealers were offering up to £50,000 for paintings he had completed while in McGabry, where he was prisoner 8385, and he signs his prisoner number on all the artwork. When he was released on parole once. He attended an exhibition of his work in East Belfast. There is certainly a demand for his art, and it reaches various amounts. There was one painting that was sold in an auction in East Belfast last year, which raised just over £1,000. Stone claims people have been buying them privately for much more. At present, I believe he is no longer able to paint because of arthritis in both hands. So whatever artwork is out there at the minute is probably what you will see coming up for sale in the years to come. Since he was released from prison finally in 2021, he has actually lived a very quiet lifestyle in County Down. He's only been photographed twice. He was photographed wearing a bulletproof jacket on a walk with his wife, who he married in while he was in McGabbery. And he was then photographed at the Orange Order's march at Stormont for the centenary. He hasn't, contrary to widespread belief, he hasn't given any big interviews since he was freed. He hasn't come forward with any new claims. He hasn't come forward to reveal anything new about his past. Now, over the years, he has made various claims about various paramilitary actions he was aware of or involved in, from plots to shoot down a helicopter carrying the then Taoiseach, Charlie Haughey, in the 1980s, to the location of some possible loyalist disappeared victims at the bottom of the Shankill where the West Link now is. How much of it is true and how much of it is a work of fiction, we'll probably never know.
Martin Breen, Ed Kern, thank you very much.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.